When land opened up to settlement in Iowa, it attracted many who were looking for a better life. It also drew some who were looking for paradise. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Week. All week long on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we'll be exploring unexpected Iowa. And today, we start the journey with Iowa's utopian communities.
They have communal labor. They have mutual support. They're a tight-knit community. They have walls between them and the world beyond.
Many came here in the hope of becoming closer to God, but at least one Iowa utopia was built to leave the church behind. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Is this heaven? We all know the answer to that question, but Iowa's allure has drawn some surprising groups of people to the state over the last two centuries. People who've come here seeking land, freedom, and privacy to build their own utopian communities. This hour, we'll talk about some of the utopian communities that have been built in Iowa. And we're starting with Peter Hanley. He is the president and journal editor of the Communal Studies Association based in Amana. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And there are a number of different groups, and we will get into the history of several of these groups this hour, that have come to Iowa over the years seeking to build utopian communities. Does Iowa have more of these than other places?
Iowa has a very large number of communal groups, at least a dozen in the mid-19th century. That's a larger number than you'll see farther west or in the south. In New England and in states like Ohio and Indiana, you will see more communal groups having started because they're farther east and were more settled at the time that utopianism really reached its high point in the 1830s and 1840s.
Now, I think a lot of us would like to think, well, people probably came to Iowa to build these utopian communities because it's so beautiful here and it's so progressive here, maybe some things like that. But what was the draw?
It so happened that the early settlement of Iowa really coincided with the rise in utopian idealism in the 1840s, particularly people were following Charles Fourier, who was a French utopian thinker, and Robert Owen, who had first come to the United States in the late 1820s. So Iowa was open ground. It was available. It was known to be good farmland. It was known to have that isolation that people like when they're trying to establish a new order of things. It was really just a blank canvas. You know, it was not quite total wilderness. It had good connection on the Mississippi River. And, of course, as you go into the 1850s and 60s with the railroads to the east, so it was easy to move people and goods here and back. And it just proved to be a really rich canvas in which the utopian picture could be painted.
So the timing was right and the land was right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, I want to dig into one of these utopian communities in Iowa, and it's one that a lot of us don't think of. Of course, I think the one that most people think of first is the Amana colonies, and we'll talk about that in depth later this hour. But let's talk about Pella and the people who settled that community. Who were they?
They were Dutch immigrants. They were basically the congregation of a man named Dominie, or it's a term for minister, Henrik Peter Scholte, or Scholte. And they basically left Holland because of religious persecution and came together as a unit to the United States. They literally had a good amount of common money that they kept in a large locked iron safe, came up the river to St. Louis, and Scholte and some others came to explore a new site for them in Iowa. And they were able to locate a nice area in Marion County, purchased the land, laid out the town, and began a settlement. Now, they never really practiced community of goods, And so you wouldn't think of them necessarily as a communal society, but they were certainly very much a planned community, and in many other ways they fit our criteria for what a utopian society at this time was, which is shared beliefs, living in a small area relative to one another, sharing some goods and services, certainly having common ideals, and going about their settlement with a plan and a purpose.
How many followers of Domine Sculti were there? How large was this group?
I believe it was around 800.
So,
and
oh,
they came
large
in 1847.
Group.
And there's a neat story about him having gone to make the exploration party, and I believe while they were at they were visiting this one land agent, a member of the land agent's family died, and the Domine, feeling, you know, he was a minister, he would stay there and see what he could do to help. And on the way to or from the cemetery, he got into conversation with a man who told him about this nice tract in Marion County, and that's why they settled on that site. And, you know, as legend has it, he put a post in the ground and wrote the word Pella, which is a biblical term meaning city of refuge. He wrote Pella on the shingle, nailed it to the board, went back to St. Louis and brought his people north. And his wife, Maria, who was a very refined lady, said, basically when they got there, Domine, where is Pella? And he said, you're in the middle of it.
It was not what she expected, huh?
Not what she expected at all. And they talk about that chest of money being drawn by a team of oxen and these four burly Dutchmen guarding it as they made their way north.
How successful was this community?
So successful that they proved to be a draw for later Dutch immigrants from the Netherlands. Domine Sculti actually did quite well for himself financially as a land speculator and dealer. And eventually the area got so settled up that later Dutch went and founded Orange City in northwestern Iowa. There just wasn't space anymore.
So Orange City is not so much a Dutch settlement, but an Iowan Dutch settlement. These weren't people coming directly from the Netherlands.
It is some folks, I believe, coming directly from the Netherlands, but certainly, you know, they were not able to build, find a home or buy land in the area around Pella any longer, and so they just went off and formed a new settlement.
Now, of course, people in Iowa know that Pella is still a beautiful and successful community. Mm-hmm. Can we put a sort of a historical marker on how long this original group lasted in that community?
I would say in some ways they still continue to this day. Certainly the Domine was very adamant that his people would immediately become American citizens. And as I recall, they actually had a justice of the peace come in to begin the preliminary work for swearing them in, you know, and the citizenship process within a few weeks. And he also started publishing a newspaper in English so that they would have to learn that language. People really came into that community from all parts of the Netherlands, not necessarily adhering specifically to his religious views. And so there were other churches there, and it really became more of a Dutch settlement rather than a colony after, I would say, the first few years.
There are still people who are drawn to Iowa because of the land, because of the privacy, because of opportunities here that may not exist in other states. One of those groups are the Amish. We still have Amish who are drawn to Iowa because there is land available. Can you give me an idea? I mean, obviously, there are different Amish communities in the state, different orders of Amish that come to the state, but this is a significant growing part of our population, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's always been expanding, and certainly there are the first Amish settlements in Iowa are going to be in Johnson County right around the time of statehood, 1846. Old order Amish communities, and then in the early part of the 20th century, they started move up towards independence, and then, of course, down to Milton, Pulaski, and so on. A lot of that has to do with people moving from the east. You know, Amish folks out there are getting crowded and have a lot of interference from visitors, and so it's a good idea to move to maybe where it's a little more isolated, but also because of divisions within the different Amish communities. You know, there are differences of opinion about what types of technology should be allowed or different practices should be adhered to, and they take them very seriously, and that has led to some different groups forming.
And do you feel like Amish communities meet this definition that you have of the utopian communities in Iowa?
I do. And when I was at Iowa State, of course, I did my graduate work under Dorothy Schweder, and she was the first person to really do a lot of research on the Iowa Amish, and she always lumped them in with the utopian groups. And I think that was mainly based on the idea that they have communal labor, they have mutual support, they're a tight-knit community, they're definitely here for a purpose. They have walls between them and the world beyond. That's probably the most significant thing to talk about, that they have a fence around their community, figuratively, that they don't associate with the outside world. And that's where with Pella, you see it being less of such a utopian society, because they really had a permeable wall, much more permeable wall, and integrated very quickly with the Americans around them. At least that's my impression.
Do you think that having that wall is really necessary to the long-term success of one of these communities, to maintain the community in the way that it was founded?
Yes. Yes, that you'll see later is for example, with Amana and Icaria, some of these longer life communities certainly faced many challenges in their later years, but the most significant was always the influence of the outside world. The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence, and young people who are born within a community are naturally drawn to that outside world that they only get to see bits and snatches of.
Peter, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Peter Hanley is president and journal editor of the Communal Studies Association. He's based in Amana. We're spending this hour talking about utopian communities in Iowa. It's part of Iowa Week on the talk shows here on Iowa Public Radio, and we'd love to hear from you throughout the week. Share some of your unexpected Iowa facts. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, hashtag Unexpected Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about people who came to Iowa seeking to build utopian communities. And many of these stories belong to the past, when available land was the main draw. But there is one community that didn't begin in Iowa until 1974. Joseph Weber is the author of Transcendental Meditation in America, How a New Age Movement Remade a Small Town in Iowa, and he is on the line with me now. Hello, Joe.
Great to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And, of course, Maharshi Mahesh Yogi, he became a very well-known figure in the 1960s and 70s. He launched the Transcendental Meditation movement. He was guru to the stars, including, of course, the Beatles. Where does Iowa come into this story?
It was an opportunity that I think he couldn't turn down. There was a small college there called Parsons College. It had been around for about 99 years or so. It fell into hard times, went bankrupt. The campus became available, and his movement snapped it up for a song, about $2.5 million. I also believe, although I don't have evidence to support this, but I believe that there was something very appealing to people in the movement about the idea of being close to the center of the geographic center of the U.S., that they felt that they could influence the entire country more effectively from there.
So it was partially a financial decision.
Correct.
But that may have had something to do with it as well, because there was a university in Santa Barbara in California.
Correct.
That closed and they moved to Iowa.
Yeah, they were in rented space in California, and they really needed, and they were just jammed to the gills. You have to understand that this movement back in the 70s was really a global phenomenon, and, you know, incredibly popular movement. And so there are a lot of people that were interested in it, and a good number of folks were going to their university. So they needed more room to kind of spread their wings, and Iowa gave them a great opportunity for that.
Well, and to go along with stereotypes here, California did seem like the perfect place to attract followers.
Absolutely. In fact, the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi had set up shop there back in 1959, and he had enlisted a number of prominent stars. California was quite receptive to the idea of meditation at a time when the rest of the country was somewhat skeptical of it. He was able to really have a lot of influence from that base. So it was, you know, it was a logical place for them. Iowa obviously seems like a rather different place.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of good church-going people in Iowa who don't have a particular interest in newfangled pursuits, particularly spiritual ones. At least that was the problem. Now, in fact, as you know, if you've been looking into the utopian communities, there have been a lot of utopian communities all around the state that have had their eyes on the skies long before these folks. So there is some history of it in the state. Still, if you look at the population of the folks in Fairfield in particular, you know, church-going farmers don't have a great deal of interest in this. And there is still, even today, 40 years on, there is still some tension between the local folks and the people associated with the movement.
So when they bought the university and moved to Fairfield, can you give me an idea of what the community, I mean, a lot of us know Fairfield today, which is a fascinating community to visit, but can you give me an idea of what Fairfield was like when the Transcendental Meditation movement came to town?
Well, I imagine it was like a lot of other towns in rural America, which is to say it was a pretty and pleasant place. Parsons College actually had somewhat of a wild reputation as a college of last resort for draft dodgers and some folks who didn't do too well in other schools. It's part of the reason that it was undone. But despite that Parsons College problem, it was, you know, probably a fairly pleasant place where people went to the county fair and, you know, kind of enjoyed rural pursuits. So this was definitely an exotic import.
And when the university started up then here, how many followers came to Iowa, came to Fairfield?
It was a very significant number, considering the population there. And the numbers have stayed relatively constant. The population has been in the neighborhood of 10,000 or so for a while. It's about 9,500 now. And about 2,000 folks actually came here. And they came in two waves. There was the initial setup of the university in 1974. And then in 1979, the guru issued a call to the followers to come and settle in Iowa. And he had very specific reasons for doing that. One of the tenets, kind of organizing principles of TM, is that if enough people meditate in a given place or a given number of times each day, then they will actually send out peaceful vibes that will tend to lower the temperatures and violence and crime and all sorts of things all around a country. Kind of an unusual idea, but it became an organizing principle. And he wanted enough people in Fairfield to be able to meet the numerical requirements and meditate and influence peace all across the U.S.
Now, he had followers all over the world and other institutions all over the world. How much time did he spend in Fairfield?
Not a lot. I think he was here only a couple times, maybe. In fact, I'm not even sure if he... I don't know, actually. I know I am aware of a visit that he made electronically, but I'm not sure if he spent much time here, if any.
So he called on his followers to settle in Iowa, but that was not something he was interested in doing.
He was not interested in moving here. He was not interested in moving here.
Now, with all of these followers descending on Fairfield, as I mentioned, anybody who's visited Fairfield can see the influence of this movement. Many of the local businesses serve, for example, vegetarian food, and there is a strong local foods, a strong organic foods movement in Fairfield. There also have been schools added on in addition to the university. But then, just recently, really, there came an idea to actually build a new town, a new city, Maharshi Vedic City, which was incorporated on July 25th of 2001. What is the idea behind this community?
Maharshi Vedic City really is organized around a spa. There is a spa there that caters to the rich and famous people like Jim Carrey, the comedian, would go there for various treatments and sessions and TM and natural eating and so on. The place is amazing. It's like a French chalet. You really feel coddled when you're there. I stayed there once, and it's quite impressive. So it's built around that, and there's a second hotel there as well. So the idea is that people can come there and enjoy these spa facilities. In addition, they wanted to build housing that would be occupied by meditators. And they had visions of a much bigger community. I'm not sure that those visions will ever be realized. The place, the spa is still quite impressive. The other hotel is pretty impressive. The housing is pretty thin, and they really haven't developed as much as they had hoped to.
And there's a very small population. 259 people is the number that I saw from the 2010 census.
Yeah, it's a very, very modest population indeed. And I think their grand ambitions really have not been realized. And it's frankly, that's not the only place that the movement's grand ambitions have not been realized. They also wanted to build another university in Smith Center, Kansas, which is the actual geographic center of the U.S. And if you look at it now, there's about 11 unfinished buildings there, and their visions of having 40,000 students have really come to naught. You know, what one of the problems that the movement ran into is, they've always had very grandiose visions, frankly, about growth and expansion, which seemed possible in the 70s, much less so since then. And, of course, the death of the guru in 2008 really robbed them of their main charismatic personality. And they haven't had anybody since that really has risen to that level. So as a result, we don't see the kind of attention that they got when they were getting on the covers of Time magazine and the Saturday Evening Post and even Mad magazine back in the 60s and 70s.
Now, I can't claim to remember when they came to Iowa, when this movement came to Iowa, but I can imagine that there were a lot of people who thought this was a flash in the pan, that this wasn't going to last in small-town Iowa. And it has. It has endured now for 40 years. When you look into the future, we've been talking about utopian communities in Iowa that are a part of the past. Do you see this as something that will endure here?
You know, that's a very hard call to make. I could see how some elements of the movement will endure both in Iowa and outside. There is an effort, for instance, to get TM taught in the public schools, and there are some prominent folks that support that effort. They still get some occasional mentions in television through celebrities that are involved in TV. That sort of thing may persist for a while. I think the university, there's reason to believe that it may persist for a while. There's still some demand among a relatively small number of students for schooling there, mostly foreign students and mostly people pursuing master's degrees. So those things argue for success and continuation. The main thing that is their biggest problem is they don't really have a young generation of leadership. They haven't really planned for succession The people who run the place now are nowhere near as charismatic, as I said, as the guru was. There are people in Iowa who've been associated with the movement who say basically this thing dies with the baby boom generation. Now, most of the folks who settled in Fairfield with the movement are now, you know, they're baby boomers, so they're in their mid-60s or north of that. We don't see an influx of other folks coming in, so it's kind of hard to see that there's going to be much there in Iowa going forward. They could pull it off. They could have somebody who rises to the fore and takes all of this knowledge that they have to give and espouses it, but the signs don't look so good right now.
Joe, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Joseph Weber is the author of the new book, Transcendental Meditation in America, How a New Age Movement Remade a Small Town in Iowa. You're listening to Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about Iowa's utopian communities. In a moment, we'll talk about Iowa's best-known utopia, the Amana Colonies, also known as the Community of True Inspiration. But now, we'll look to southwest Iowa, where a community of French Icarians settled in what became Adams County. While most of the pilgrims who came to Iowa seeking to build utopian communities were making an effort to be closer to God, the Icarians were a non-religious group. In fact, Icaria was the longest-lived, non-religious, pure communal experiment in the history of the United States. And Sandra Leininger is on the line with us now. She's executive director of the French Icarian Colony Foundation. Hello, Sandra.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And like so many utopian communities, this was the brainchild of one man. Tell me about him.
Well, his name was Etienne Cabet. He was born in France in 1788. His father was a barrel maker, but as a young child, he was very sickly, and his dad felt that he wouldn't be able to follow in the family business. So they made sure he had a good education. And he ended up one of the youngest people in the Chamber of Deputies, and he was a real thorn in the side of the unstable French government. He was a champion of the working class, and his actions and outbursts became so irritating to the government that in 1834 they brought him before a court, and he had a choice of either going into exile or going to prison. He chose exile. While he was in exile in England, he studied Utopia, Sir Thomas More's book on Utopia, and developed his ideas and his theories about how life should be.
And he even wrote quite a long novel about ideal of a utopian community that was published in 1840.
Right. And while they didn't adhere to just one religion, everybody that joined the community were several different religions were represented. They did believe in following the principles of Christ.
And what specifically were the principles that were most important to this community?
The golden rule, to do unto others as you want them to do unto you. Their motto was all for one and one for all. And they believed that everybody should be treated the same. There shouldn't be rich and poor and that sort of thing.
And I have to say, the motto obviously sounds very much like the Three Musketeers, which was published in 1844. Was this was Alexandre Dumas a contemporary of Etienne Cabet?
I don't know.
All right, we'll have to look into that.
Period.
Right. So, you mentioned the unstable French government. This was all happening right before the French Revolution.
That's correct.
And Cabet decided to leave for America. Mm-hmm. What was his plan?
Well, his plan was he had purchased 1,000 acres of land in Texas from the Peters Land Company and the state of Texas. And when they arrived, they thought it would be all contiguous, one big plot of land. And what they had sold them was every other half section. So they had, in essence, a checkerboard. There wasn't enough land to really put together the colony that he wanted. And it was only about 2 or 3 weeks later that the French Revolution started, which eased his position in France, but he had already purchased the land, and they were already made their plans, so they came ahead and came to America.
All right,
then
but
in
Texas, 1848. But Texas was a disaster.
It was a disaster. First of all, they weren't prepared for the kind of weather they found there. Several of the men died of malaria, so they went back to New Orleans to wait for Cabet to arrive. In the meantime, other Icarian supporters had arrived in New Orleans, so that first winter they spent in New Orleans.
All right, and from there they went to Nauvoo, Illinois, and that's a story for another day.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a Mormon community, but the Mormons were leaving and moving on, so they moved in.
Yes, they did. They bought land and buildings from the Mormons and moved in, and that's where they set up their colony in America.
All right, but from there they went to Iowa.
Yes, people started encroaching in there, it was becoming more, as Cabet said, civilized. He was looking west to find land that was a little more isolated. And so in 1852, he started sending people over to southwest Iowa, which had been a state for 6 years, but the western part hadn't settled into counties yet. And they purchased 3,000 acres of land to build a new colony in southwest Iowa.
All right, and we'll talk about that colony in just a moment. We're talking about Icaria, which was the longest-lived, non-religious, pure communal experiment in the history of the United States, and it took place here in Iowa, in what became Adams County. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. This hour, we're talking about utopian communities in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa and River to River. All week long, we're exploring unexpected Iowa. And this hour, we're talking about Iowa's utopian communities. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, the community of true inspiration, the Amana colonies. Right now, we're talking about one of Iowa's utopian communities that I think is much less known, Icaria, which was in Adams County. And it was actually the longest-lived, non-religious, pure communal experiment in the history of the United States. And with me on the line, Sandra Leininger. She is the executive director of the French Icarian Colony Foundation. And we had just gotten to the point where this community came to Iowa. In 1852, Cabet was sending his followers to Iowa, although he did not come himself.
No, he didn't. I think he was still in France at that. Well, no, when they came, that was after the split in Nauvoo, and he and a few of his followers went to Cheltenham, Missouri, which is a suburb of St. Louis. Like a lot of people in power, Cabet became a bit of a dictator, and he was ousted as president for the first time. And so he took some of his followers and went south.
All right, so the Icaria was founded in Iowa. How many settlers came?
That first group, I think there was around 300 to 350 people came to Iowa.
And it was a truly communal community, right?
Yes, yes. They each lived in, at first they built log cabins for each family, which just had a sitting room in their bedrooms, because they all came together for their meals three times a day. And the heart of the colony was their refectory or communal dining hall. And that was where they held their musicals and their plays and did the governing of the colony as well as for meals.
And arts and culture were a very important part of life in the colony, right?
Yes, it was. And as a total group, they were a little different than a lot of immigrant groups that came, as most of them had the equivalent of a university education and had been tradespeople in France, not farmers.
And that made them quite popular among their neighbors, right?
Yes, we were pretty sparsely populated, yes. in southwest Iowa. And so people think of communes as being closed down, but they were very known for their hospitality and very open and would invite the other neighbors to come in and on Sundays and for their plays and their musicals. They had a band. They had artists. They also tutored some of the children before we had schools here.
So it was a... They would perform for their neighbors.
Yes, sort of exactly.
A cultural center there in southwestern
exactly.
Iowa.
Yes.
And they did occasionally leave the community as well. You write about them marching in the 4th of July parade.
Mm-hmm.
Was that in Corning?
Yes, that was in Corning. And some of their men served in the Civil War. Some of them held positions such as township trustees and things like that. So they did participate in the community somewhat.
How did it end? What happened?
Well, it ended, the original colony was broken up in 1878 when some of the younger people did not like the way the older people were running the colony, and it ended up in district court. So there was a split. And then the younger people, the judge gave the old original colony to the young people, and the elders had to move about a mile and a half southeast of the original colony and build a new colony. And they built a refectory and some two-story, two-family dwellings. And they also were given some of the other buildings, so they had to move them during the winter across the land to the new colony. Left them with a lot of older people, so they had to hire more and more people to come in and help them with things. And the young people that were left in that colony decided, hey, I would like to dress like these other people. As they became more integrated and making friends with these new workers that came in from the outside community, they started to change. And, of course, as I said, they were older people, so they weren't having more family. So the
right.
colony quit growing, and so they disbanded finally in 1898.
So what would you say is the legacy of the Icarians in Iowa?
I would say we did a study a few years ago. I would say the legacy is their practices in agriculture. They introduced a lot of new foods to Iowa and southwest Iowa in particular when they came, the grapes, apples. They shared their knowledge with other pioneers.
They also brought lilacs and other horticultural
and
plants,
iris,
right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Many things that people around here didn't know about or hadn't seen before. And I think the legacy of their art and all of that has been a very much a part of our county here.
Well, Sandra, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, you're very welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.
Sandra Leininger is executive director of the French Icarian Colony Foundation, where they're keeping this history alive. We're talking about utopian communities on Talk of Iowa today, Iowa's utopian communities, and now Iowa's most famous utopian community, the Amana Colonies, also known as the Community of True Inspiration, arguably the most successful of these communities in Iowa. Lanny Haldy is the executive director of the Amana Heritage Society. We're here with me now. Hello, Lanny.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here.
And all right, let's go back in time. This story begins a very long time ago in 1714 in Germany. What was happening?
Well, a lot of people weren't happy with what was happening in the established church at the time, which at that time was the Lutheran church in that part of Germany. Many people tried to reform the church from within, but others, like the Community of True Inspiration, broke away from the church completely and started their own group.
All right. And they had a number of problems in Germany. They tried to keep to themselves and build a community in Germany, but there continued to be persecution.
There continued to be bad economic times, so that eventually, but not right away, not until the 1840s, they finally decided that it was time to look to America and give up Germany. And like a lot of people in Europe and Germany at the time, America was the place to start over.
All right. And they didn't come to Iowa at first. They went to Buffalo, New York, and they built the Ebenezer Society there. What was the core principle of this community?
The core principle was that life was a spiritual journey towards salvation. And they set up a way of life that would help them on that journey. They unlike some of the other groups like the Icarians that we talked about or the Transcendental folks, they really weren't trying to present a model for other people to follow. They were just trying to set up a way of life that would work for them and lead to their ultimate spiritual salvation.
And they were quite successful in Buffalo, New York, and to the point where they needed more land and more space, right?
Very successful. That's in a way kind of the irony, is that they really weren't concerned about material things, but they built a very successful and quite wealthy communal society in New York. They wanted to expand. Buffalo, the city of Buffalo, had been growing so that land prices were going up. They also felt maybe threatened by the outside influences of Buffalo at the time. So they looked to Iowa, and as Peter Hanley had mentioned, Iowa was the place to go in the 1850s.
So they came to Iowa, and they found this beautiful, beautiful land. Tell me about the settlement here. How many people moved to Iowa?
Well, it took a long time. They eventually, over a period of a decade or two, they eventually were able to purchase some 26,000 acres, which is a tremendous amount of land in the state of Iowa. And eventually, within a generation, their population grew to about 1,800 people. And they built 7 villages, built over 500 structures in those villages. It was really remarkable what they did accomplish. And visitors from the outside would marvel at the success and the affluence of the Amana Society, as they called themselves.
And what did that mean? What does Amana mean?
Amana is a word taken from the Song of Solomon in the Bible. It means generally remain faithful or to believe faithfully. When they first came to Iowa, they actually named their settlement Bleibtreu. Okay, it's even hard to say today. Bleibtreu, which means remain true. They soon realized that the English tongue can't say that very easily, as I just proved.
Right.
And so they looked to the Bible for a word that would mean about the same thing, and they found the word Amana, which actually is a river and a mountain in Palestine. So they named their settlement Amana. They had taken their word Ebenezer from the Bible as well when they settled in New York. So it was kind of a natural thing for them to do.
And how did the communal part of this community work? You mentioned that over time they built 7 villages. Were the villages sort of separate unto themselves, and those were communal living situations?
Yes, in many ways the villages were autonomous. However, there was a board of trustees that oversaw the economic, social, and spiritual life of the entire community, all 7 villages. Within those villages, there was some autonomy in terms of the agriculture and who would become elders and things like that. But for the most part, they viewed themselves as one community, not a series of 7 communities.
Now, I have to believe that the success of this community, and as you mentioned, they weren't looking for material goods, but it was a wealthy, a well-off community. I have to believe that that is partially responsible for the endurance of the community, as many of these smaller communities, if life wasn't good there, people didn't stay. But people wanted to stay in the Amanas.
For the most part, people wanted to stay, and if they didn't want to stay, they were free to go. And we have many instances where people thought, again, like Peter said, that the grass was greener on the other side of the fence. They found out maybe it wasn't, and then they came back. And unlike some other groups where those people were not allowed back, Amana most often let them come back. And we have instances, many instances, where people came and went several times and found that life in a manor wasn't as bad as maybe they had thought it was.
Now, you mentioned that visitors were very impressed by the structures and the culture of the Amana colonies. What were interactions with visitors like? I mean, part of the success of communal societies is sort of keeping up that wall around the community.
Yeah, that's right. But not all walls are totally impenetrable. And certainly in Amana, there were a lot of instances where the wall broke down. And in fact, where it may have broken down because of the Amana folks themselves, they needed to trade with the outside world. They were growing all kinds of agricultural goods. They had woolen mills and calico factories that they needed to trade with. So they had salesmen coming in. They had salesmen going out. They wanted the railroad, so they had depots and hotels for visitors to stay in, so that they're really, you know, they were not an isolated community even from the beginning. They tried to be separate from the rest of the world, but not isolated from. I like to think that they tried to deal with the outside world on their own terms, but not be totally separated from it.
Now, the great change came in 1932, where the community decided to no longer have all property be communal, to change to a more capitalist society. What brought about that change?
Well, for the most part, I think what brought it about, there were some economic factors, of course, but I think it was a change in attitude by the members. More and more of the members were expressing the idea that that communal structure was not necessarily part of their religious beliefs, that they could be believers and not have to conform to the strict rules of communal living. So they were separating their religious faith from that communal structure. And that's finally what happened in 1932. The church essentially jettisoned all that economic baggage and all the social baggage and said, we're going to be a church. And if you look at it that way, it wasn't a failure in 32. It was a success because the church survived. The church still exists today and, in fact, is celebrating its 300th year anniversary this year. So in a way, you could see that the communal era in Amana was just kind of one phase in the history of the community of True Inspiration, and that community still exists today.
Now, of course, most of us who don't live in the Amana colonies consider it to be a tourist attraction in the state of Iowa, beautiful place to go and shop and eat and spend time. What do you think is at the heart of the community today? Do you still believe that there is that core, the community of True Inspiration?
Certainly the church is still a major part of the community today. But even beyond that, I really get the sense, and I don't know if it can be measured or anything like that, I do get the sense that there is more a sense of community in Amana than there is in a lot of small towns. Now, I haven't lived in other small towns, so I can't say that. But all I can say is that I think there is a real sense of community in Amana that still is, comes from that communal era and that common heritage that is there.
Now, of course, people can move into the Amana colonies who are not part of the church. Do you feel like outsiders are welcome?
Oh, yes. In fact, I think outsiders can, become part of the community as much as they want to. And in fact, and looking at it from a historic preservation point of view in terms of the preserving the buildings, most often if somebody from outside of Amana moves in and buys one of these buildings, it's because they care about it and they're going to fix it up and keep it nice.
And help the history endure.
Exactly.
Lanny, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Lanny Haldy is executive director of the Amana Heritage Society. We've been talking about Iowa's utopian communities this hour as we kick off Iowa Week. All this week on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we'll be exploring unexpected Iowa. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, Iowa literature.